Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 8th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Who's On First? Baseball and American Culture, presented by David Wee. Session number WED-2005-02. Let's listen in.
I'm David Wee. I've been an English professor and a running coach at St. Olaf for 40 years, just retired. But for almost 30 of those years, I've taught a course on baseball and American culture from time to time. And I must tell you that when I go to meetings of English teachers and English professors at various places, and we sit down and say, well, what do you teach? And it's Victorian literature or creative writing. And nobody cares that I teach Victorian literature, but when I say I teach a course on baseball and American culture, they all say, you lucky guy! How do you get to do that? And it's become very clear to me, as perhaps to some of you, how widespread a love of baseball is in the academic world as well as all over the country. So what I'd like to do in my baseball course is to try to get at why. You know, why should I want to read the box scores every day and not feel quite ready to head out the front door until I've read the box scores? Why do I like to listen or watch to the Twins at night? So what I'd like to do today is just to talk a little bit with you, do some of the things I do in my baseball course, and let you know what it is that we take up, what kind of questions we do in a college course for full credit on baseball. And that's what these subtopics over on the left are. These are some of the things that we take up in a college course on baseball. But I'll start the way I usually begin each class, because just as people in the ice cream line, you know, don't get here until the second or third inning, same with college students, you know, they tend to trickle in for a few minutes, and rather than shut the door on them, I begin with what I call batting practice. That's for those who like batting practice, they come early. And the batting practice is simply asking a bunch of questions about baseball numbers or baseball history. And I found that the students are really anxious to, you know, see if they can answer the questions. And when I'm talking to another audience, like this one, it is sometimes stunning to many of us to discover what sort of specific trivia baseball people know. So just to get a sense of this audience, I've got some numbers written here on this side of the board, and we'll just see how our how learned we are about baseball lore. The number 2,130. Does anybody
know? Lou Gehrig?
No, Cal Ripken. No, you're right. It's Lou. It's Lou Gehrig. What?
Number of hits, consecutive games. Okay.
Number of consecutive games that Lou Gehrig played. So for many years, that was the record. 0.215, a batting average. Does anyone know what that is?
It's not too good.
All right, you got it.
The Mendoza line?
The Mendoza line. And why is it called the Mendoza line?
Who played for Seattle for a few years, I guess, and the... That's how bad he hit, and it became the barometer for whether you fell off and went to the minors or something.
Mario Mendoza played for a dozen years, I think, in the major leagues, and this was his lifetime batting average. Oh. And for a regular player to stay in the big leagues and bat only .215, which is not very good, is an embarrassment. So every player desperately tries to bat better than .215. And Mario Mendoza has given his name to that benchmark. 56. What does the number 56 represent?
Babe Ruth?
No.
Roger Maris?
Yeah,
760.
No.
Consecutive hits.
Oh, yeah. Is that DiMaggio's?
Consecutive games.
That's it. It's the number of consecutive games in which Joe DiMaggio got a base hit. Hmm. No one's come close. You know who's got the second best? Anybody?
Ichiro.
Not Ichiro. Pete Rose.
Pete Rose.
Has 44 hits in 44 consecutive games. So that's Joe DiMaggio. Batting average of .406.
That's Ted Williams.
And that is the last time any Major League ball player has batted over 400. You know, another very high benchmark. 400 in a season. Do you know when, what year he did that?
Oh, October 3rd,
1951? 1961.
No.
Was it that late?
No. Remember what year that was? Or this one? Joe DiMaggio's consecutive game streak. They were both in 1940.
During the war.
Right before the war.
1941.
41.
Both of them. Just before the U.S. went into the war. So both of those happened at once. Okay, October 3rd, 1951.
Shot heard around the world.
The shot heard around the world. Can you explain that?
Is that Bobby Thompson's home run?
That's right.
Giants and the
Dodgers. Okay. And what was remarkable about it, in part, was that I think it was on August 5th, something like that, the Giants were 13 and a half games behind the Los Angeles Dodgers and caught them in the last 6 weeks of the season, tied them on the last day of the regular season. There was a best of three playoff series. They got down to the third game, and in the last half of the last inning, Bobby Thompson hit a home run. You probably know who he hit it off, too.
I can't remember now.
Anybody? Off Ralph Branca, whose name has become infamous. Although, interestingly enough, Bobby Thompson and Ralph Branca, the home run hitter and the pitcher who lost the pennant, have become good friends, and they travel around the country appearing at baseball events as friends. And the home run, by the way, went over the head of my baseball hero, Andy Pafko, who for a season and a half played for the Los Angeles Dodgers, or the Brooklyn Dodgers. And the home run went, he had his back pressed to the wall looking up. 1.12. I'll tell you that this is
a good earned run average.
It's a very good earned run average. Do you know whose it is?
Sandy Koufax.
No.
Bob Feller.
No. Good guesses, though. This was Bob Gibson.
Gibson. I heard it.
Gary.
I missed that. Bob Gibson. Do you know what year that was?
62.
Close. I'll answer that in a second. And batting average of .301. You know that? That was the lowest league-leading batting average ever, done by Carl Yastrzemski of the Red Sox in 1968. And Bob Gibson's earned run average for a full season of a starting pitcher, just incredibly low, and that was the same year, 1968.
Pitcher's year.
And it was also the year, do you remember what else happened for pitchers?
They lowered the mound after.
Mm-hmm. Denny McClain?
Denny McClain won 31 games. That's the last time a pitcher has ever won 30 games or more. And because the pitchers had such an advantage, they lowered the height of the pitching mound from 15 inches to 10. One of the rare dimension changes that baseball has ever made in trying to equal things off.
Danny McClain did something important on September 14th, 1968. What was it?
September
14th. 1968.
Willie Horton hit a game-winning single in the ninth, and our son Carl was born.
Oh. was better. Our son is 6'5". You know.
Hey.
Yeah. Okay.
It's got to be. Got to be him. This number, 2,632.
That's
Calvert.
That's Calvert
Junior. Yeah. He broke this record that people thought would never be broken, and he played in this many consecutive games, which is what, 15, 16 seasons in a row without missing a game. Okay, 511. I didn't know that.
Home run.
That serves. Home run is, Hank Aaron's got more than that. I'm going to tell you a little story to lead up to this. I was doing this very exercise with a class of St. Olaf alumni who were back on campus 3 or 4 years ago for commencement weekend. And it was a room with 40, 50 people in it. And there was a little 9-year-old girl who was in the audience. And at every number that I asked, Madeline's hand went. She was very polite. I called on her a couple times, and she always knew the right answer, but she didn't blurt it out. And finally, we came to 511, and Madeline's was the only hand up. I didn't know her name yet at this point. And I said, what's 511? And she said, well, that's the major league record for the most wins in a career by a pitcher, and it was done by Cy Young. And everyone's jaws just And then a man who I learned later turned out to be a 60-year-old Chicago lawyer raised his hand and said, oh, and by the way, that's the number of career home runs that Ernie Banks hit. Madeline's hand went up. She said, Ernie Banks hit 512 home runs. She was right.
Well, we learned later that was her favorite player.
Yeah.
And when asked why, she said, because he's an optimist.
Yeah.
Didn't even have to do with baseball. Yeah. He's an optimist.
And then later in this hour, I had carelessly said that the Yankees had traded with the Red Sox and gotten Babe Ruth, and baseball history was changed. And after the class was over, this sweet little Madeline came up to me and said, Professor Wee, she said, the Red Sox didn't trade Babe Ruth to the Yankees, they sold him because the owner needed money to put on a play in Boston. This was correct, you know, and I knew that, but I hadn't been thinking, and I carelessly said, traded instead of sold. And bless her, she had the grace, didn't mind correcting one of the other students in the class, even if he was, you know, six times her age. But she didn't want to embarrass me in front of the class. It came up afterwards to correct me quietly and not in the presence of anyone. I ran down to my office and got a baseball and got her autograph. And invited her to teach the class with me the next year. And she did. So we did it together in the Minneapolis newspapers and TV stations. Picked this up as a great story. And so we were interviewed, Madeline and I, on the Minneapolis television station the day the season opened that next year. And of course, they weren't interested in me, but they were asking a lot of questions of Madeline. And I was sitting there grinning. And the interviewer said, well, now, Madeline, how did you get interested in baseball at your age? And she said, well, my grandpa and my dad were following the Mark McGuire-Sammy Sosa home run race that season and talking about it all the time. So I began to get interested. And she was only 8 years old at that time. And he said, yes, but how do you know so much baseball historical information as all this? She said, well, I have lots of books at my house, and I read them. She is one of these just encyclopedic minds who remembers everything. So we've got a pretty well-informed and knowledgeable audience tonight here as well, so that helps me know what's going here. Now, another thing that is almost a lost art in baseball. Yes?
You didn't say what 363
was. Oh, all right. 363. Good. Who knows what 363 is?
Madeline does.
That's me.
Think left-handers. Think the Braves. This is the major league record for wins by a left-handed pitcher. Warren Spahn.
Warren Spahn.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a toughie, though. It's... Now the art of nicknames has perhaps largely disappeared, but we all, most of us my age, you know, grew up knowing players by their nicknames. So I'll just read off a nickname, and you all shout out who it is. Babe.
Ruth.
Dizzy.
Baby.
Say hey.
Willie Mays.
All right. The Iron Horse. Okay. The Big Train.
Walter Johnson.
The Yankee Clipper.
Joe
DiMaggio. Boog.
Oh.
Okay. Hammer and Hank.
Aaron.
Charlie Hustle.
Pete Rose.
Oh, see? Yeah. People all known by their nicknames. Here's a few that... We'll test you a little bit harder. Vinegar Bend.
Mizell.
You know how he got that nickname? That was the name of his hometown in West Virginia, I think, or North Carolina. Vinegar Bend Mizell. Bow Wow. His name was Hank Arft. Dr. Strange Glove.
Oh, was that?
Anyone remember Dr. Strange Glove? This was Dick Stewart, who was an ill-fielding first baseman from the Pittsburgh Pirates back at the time that the movie Dr. Strange Glove hit the screen. He was such a bad fielder that they called him Dr. Strange Glove. And here's the last one, The Ancient Mariner.
Edgar Martinez.
Well, good. Do they actually call him that? There was a mariner who had this nickname. Necro. Phil Necro, wasn't he a mariner? And he was 43 years old and he was still playing. And he had the nickname the Ancient Mariner. But it's also a kind of generic nickname that baseball players use for an ill-fielding shortstop, a bad-fielding infielder. And do you know why the Ancient Mariner? Any of you know how Coleridge's Ancient Mariner begins?
Stop the 23.
Yeah, there you are. It is an Ancient Mariner, and
stop with one of three.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, if the fielder only stops one of three, he's an Ancient Mariner. Okay.
Do you have the big unit?
I didn't ask that, the big unit, but I figured, Randy Johnson, yeah. Okay, very good, shucks, you've got almost all of those. Here's a couple of other little statistical things. How much does a baseball weigh? Nothing feels better than holding a baseball, so. You know how much it weighs? Do you know what its circumference is? Isn't it funny? We can sort of play catch for a lifetime, and those are things we don't think about very much.
5 inches.
9-inch circumference. 5 ounces, though, is the weight of a baseball. Do you know how many stitches baseball has? First, how many seams?
Yeah,
One seam, that's right. And how many stitches? It's got 108, or 216 if you count each half stitch.
Has that changed at all since the baseball was first made?
Probably not since it was first regularized. But see, people know the religious significance, even to the number of stitches. Okay, and then here's a few more just to get us warmed up. And one of my favorite baseball question books is called Who Was Harry Steinfeld? And Other Baseball Trivia Questions. And I love some of these questions because it doesn't matter that you don't know who is the answer to the question. But the question, the fact that this sort of thing could have happened at some point in baseball history is really fun. Who hit into a triple play on his last time at bat in his major league career? You might guess this person played for a team famous for its futility. The Mets, right? The Mets in their first year. It was Joe Pignatano, who was the catcher for the Mets, playing a game against the Cubs, the last game of the season. Two on, nobody out. And he hit a looper over the second baseman who raced back and caught it and threw to second, threw to first. And end of ball game, end of season, end of career, all at once. Triple play. And I ran across in the paper a couple of years ago a report about this game, which was the 120th loss of the season. If you're feeling sad about your Mariners and what a bad season they're having, they are not going to lose 120 games. But the Mets did in 1962. And after the game ended, word is that Casey Stengel gave a little pep talk to the team that didn't come out quite the way he planned. He stood up and said, "Fellers, I don't want you to feel bad about this. No one or two guys could have done all this." Another one that I like is who hit into the only all-Cuban triple play? And this was the answer to this was Whitey Herzog, who played for the Kansas City Royals back in a game against the Washington Senators in 1960, the year before they became the Minnesota Twins. Whitey Herzog against Camilo Pascual, who was pitching for the Senators, hit a ball that went from Camilo Pascual to Julio Baquerto to Jose Valdivielso. All Cubans. It doesn't matter, but it's fun. Name the only player whose every hit one year was a home run.
He only had one hit?
No, he actually had three hits. This was Clem Labine, a pitcher for Brooklyn and later the Los Angeles Dodgers. And in 1955, he came to bat 31 times, got only three hits, but they were all home runs. I'm sure he bragged a lot. Do you know who was the only player who struck out every time he came to bat one year?
It was a pitcher.
And it was Sandy Koufax. His first season. And that was the fewest number of strikeouts he ever got at bat. He struck out almost half the time he came to bat in his whole major league career. But his first year, every time. Okay. A couple more. What pitcher won 19 games more times than any other pitcher? Now, that winning 20 games in a season is another one of those standards, like batting 300 or so forth.
No.
Standard of excellence. Who?
Nolan?
No, not Nolan Ryan. This person is in the United States Senate at present. This was Jim Bunning, who I think is still a senator, am I right? Kentucky?
Right. Kentucky.
Yeah, okay. Four times he won only 19 games, and on the one of those years, had he won his 20th game on the last game of the season, the Philadelphia Phillies would have won the pennant. Mm-hmm. That was the year they went into the tank under Gene Mock. Okay. One or two more. Who played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, the New York Rangers hockey team, and the New York Knicks basketball team in the same season? I won't keep you on pins and needles. This was Gladys Gooding, the organist.
Oh, wow, that's a great one.
And what I think is really the most interesting and memorable trivia question, what major league pitcher has the best one-loss record against the New York Yankees? You know, and it causes you to think, you know, would he have been pitching against the Yankees in their best years when they won the pennant every time or when they weren't so good? Anybody know who? What pitcher has the best one-loss record against the mighty Yankees? The answer is Babe Ruth. Mm-hmm. He had a record of, I think it was 18-5 or something like that against the Yankees, and so they bought him. He was one of the best left-handed pitchers, one of the best pitchers in Major League Baseball in his first 4 or 5 years of his career. And then the Yankees saw his potential as a batter, bought him, stopped losing to him, and he changed baseball history because of it. Okay, one of the things that I'd like to find out from you is how, if you are one of those who has established an interest in baseball, how did it happen? How did you get interested in baseball? Because people who aren't interested really want to know, you know, how did you get this way? You know, why do you listen to games, watch games, read the box scores, learn and remember things like this? Any of you have a story about it, about that?
Well, I grew up next to a minor league town, and we got interested in baseball. Through them, and of course, at that time, and a few other people there can probably attest to that, the number of teams wasn't so great, and you knew almost everybody on every team. It wasn't like now, where you probably couldn't drop the name of maybe one person per team if you were lucky.
Yeah, okay. So you lived close to a team that you could follow and watch?
In our part of the country, almost every small town had a town team.
Okay. And where are you talking about?
In high school, and then when you got out of high school, well, you played for the town team until you went off somewhere else, so there was a natural involvement in baseball.
Yeah, okay. Good. John, you have a story.
I didn't really like baseball until 10 years ago. And it was because when I was a kid, I kind of thought of it as being too slow. But as a business, I work in the motion picture business, and I was right in the middle of a big fuss between 20th Century Fox and the Japanese motion picture studio, and I had to make both of them happy, and it gave me diarrhea for a month. So I got free tickets from a big corporation, Zillerbach Paper Company, to go to the Dodger game, and they were great seats. And I sat there, and Raul Mondesi made a great catch, and Mike Piazza made a great hit, and there were great seats, and I thought, this is great, and I completely forgot about the movie business. It should be entertaining to most people, but it was just a pain in the neck for me. And but baseball became my entertainment. And I, from then on, and it was just a perfect night. And I don't know if you've ever been to Dodger Stadium, but it's beautiful. And, look at all those. And I had a beer and a hot dog, and I was watching those great catches, and I thought, I like this. And then I found myself, I laughed at myself at home, turning on television and watching baseball games on TV, which I used to think was like watching chess on TV or something.
Yeah.
And now I said, but I thought, what? And that was the day that I started to enjoy baseball. It was just a really enjoyable, fun entertainment diversion, and I started learning more about it and finding myself reading the paper and all of the details of how they're doing.
So it happened as an adult for you. For many, there's some kind of childhood connection or a parental influence.
Well, you know, I never played baseball when I was little because I was left-handed, and I had to have a first baseman's glove from one of my older big cousins, and I could never catch anything in it. But we lived in Denmark for a year, and I came back and I was in seventh grade, and I got a paper route. And Zoyo Versailles was this great Cuban shortstop, lived on the third floor of a house on my paper office about three blocks away. So I just started to carry one of those little odd radios while I was collecting this. And every time I went to a Twins game, they lost. 3 years, and I just thought, hey, all of my junior high school career was ruined by the Twins. But I never gave up. Plus, I love to play. That's all over.
Well, I can claim genetics for myself. My grandfather emigrated from Norway, and he was a stern, pious Haugianer, Norwegian fishing lad who became a Lutheran pastor in the old Norwegian Synod and the Haugianers before that. Tall, stern man. He died when I was three, so I didn't really get to know him, but I've seen the photographs. But when I started college, I met some of my religion professors who told me that they had taken Hebrew. He taught Hebrew and Old Testament. And they told me that in the first week in October every year, he canceled all of his afternoon Hebrew classes. He was in his office listening to the World Series. So I talked to Dad about this, and Dad told a few other stories, but I learned that the reason my grandpa became interested was that Christy Mathewson was the nation's best pitcher back in the first couple decades of the 20th century. And Grandpa learned that instead of being a ruffian, like many people assumed ball players were, if you've seen Pride of the Yankees and you remember the Lou Gehrig story and his mother just thinking the baseball was just a bunch of thugs, Grandpa learned that Christy Mathewson had promised his mother that he would never play baseball on Sunday in honor of their family's religion, and that he was a graduate of a good liberal arts college, Bucknell University in Pennsylvania. So Grandpa started paying attention and got caught up, like John, you did, and started to follow it. And the extreme case, I think, happened when Grandpa had been sent by the church to Persia to check out a traveling evangelist over there. And we're talking back in the, about 1929. And he's been gone for a year out there without, you know, email or telephone or any of that, just correspondence by letter. They didn't know when he was coming home. And one day he walked in to the family house, having just come by steamship and then railroad and then streetcar up Como Avenue to the seminary at St. Paul. Family was there having Sunday dinner, and he came in and patted the kids on the head and kissed my grandma and sort of rifled through some of the mail that was gathered on the buffet. And Grandma said, well, aren't you going to take off your coat and sit down and eat with us? And he said, well, he said, on the streetcar on the way up here, I noticed that the Millers and the Saints are playing a doubleheader. And he turned around and went out the door. So, and then my dad got interested and told me once that even he and Grandpa, once when my grandmother was gone from town, and my dad was at the seminary, and he and Grandpa were together at the house, and Grandpa said, there's a ball game down at Lexington Park in St. Paul. Let's go see it. And my dad said, well, Dad, it's Sunday. You know we can't do that. And he said, well, your mother's gone. So they went to a Sunday ball game anyway. But if you think, yeah.
Oh, you know mine, could I tell them?
Oh, yes, please.
I got it, is that baseball is like church. It's usually boring, but you never know when something might happen.
When I think about my grandpa, you know, I've been gone in Persia for a year, and then first thing he wanted to do is see a ball game. Do you know what the United States government gave to the Iranian hostages when they, after their 444 days in captivity in modern Persia, in Iran? Lifetime passes to Major League Baseball. Now, this was the finest thing that our government could think of to give to people who have been deprived of a year and a half of American life. Lifetime passes to Major League Baseball. Governments haven't been so wise since. Now I'm going to read a page for you out of Newsweek that came out 5 years ago, and then we'll go through some of these categories that we take up in a baseball class. And interrupt me at any point if you'd like to ask a question or contribute something. Okay, that's fine. This is entitled The Town That Gave a Man His Life Back. It's just a one-page essay by Edith Hamilton, who I think is Edith Hamilton, who is a well-known scholar of mythology and so forth. She's writing this in 2000, when I think she was 70 years old. But this is one of my favorite little stories about the power that baseball has over some people's lives. Every spring, when the umpire yells, "Play ball!" in the first game of the season, I get teary-eyed again, wondering how that ball must have looked coming at my father on that pitcher's mound so long ago. It was a line drive in the summer of 1921, 79 years before she wrote this. A purely magic time for my father, who had been discovered by a baseball scout on a red clay ballpark in the Mississippi Hill Country. He was 26, newly married, playing pickup ball after work. I mean, this is just what you're talking about. He was a southpaw, and family legend says Dad's blazing fastball was so hard it once split his brother's hand when he caught it. How a baseball scout ever heard of my father remains a mystery, but he gave him a minor league contract to play in Exeter, Nebraska in the spring of 1921. Anyone ever been to Exeter? Exeter is a small town in southeast Nebraska where the plains begin. Its residents were crazy about baseball. They had a ball field and grandstands and intense rivalry with other minor league teams. My father's pitching statistics quickly made him a hero. My mother and their infant daughter, that is Edith Hamilton, who's writing this, my mother and their infant daughter were feted by the townspeople with gifts and attention. The team was winning, and a regional title seemed certain as summer began to wane. Dad never talked about the line drive that shattered his ankle, ended his baseball career, and left him with a lifelong limp. In later years, he would show his grandchildren how to throw a curve or a slider, and in my mind's eye, I can still see their small fingers as he wrapped them around a baseball to demonstrate. But he never talked about that hit. I was an adult before I understood that most of us do not want to talk about our worst defeats. In 1958, while driving my parents to Kansas to visit my brother, I discovered that we were not far from Exeter, and I suggested that we drive there just to see the town that I had heard about all my life. My father protested that he did not want to go, but my mother and I persuaded him. When we reached Exeter, my parents were astounded. Interstate 80 had missed the town, and the place was unchanged, quiet and serene. We were walking up the main street with my mother saying, "This is the cafe where we ate. This is the store where we bought our groceries." When we passed an elderly man who tipped his hat to us, stopped, did a classic double take, and came running back yelling, "Lefty Hamilton! You're Lefty Hamilton! You are! You are!" Don't ever tell me that baseball is not otherworldly. We went into a nearby cafe where the man got on the phone and began making calls. Soon a group of Lefty Hamilton fans, who had known my father 37 years before, hurried in and the party began. The laughter was so loud that the years seemed to vanish, leaving only that long ago summer perfectly preserved in time. I sat back watching my parents. They looked younger. My father looked happily dazed. The words of an old song came back to me, memories how they linger. The talk swirled around the table. Mm-hmm. "How about that shutout game you pitched against the day when you balked, and that suicide squeeze?" When Dad expressed surprise that people still remembered him, a man replied, "Of course we remember. It's baseball, Lefty." I was dazed myself. These wonderful people still recalled my father, Lefty Hamilton, after all those years. He had pitched on a minor league team in a very small town for one brief summer season, and they remembered him. My parents' home had burned down years before the Exeter trip, and the only photo that had survived the flames was one of my father and the Exeter baseball team. It is charred on three corners, a priceless memento. And looking at it used to sadden me, because I felt something had gone out of my father's life that summer. To have a dream come true and then have it snatched away so quickly is more devastating than never having it come true at all. But the Exeter trip changed my father. It reassured him that he was not forgotten, that the name of Lefty Hamilton still lives in baseball's pantheon of players. This October, I'll watch the World Series, and I will forget the obscene salaries, the fields that resemble amusement parks under the lights, the rent-a-player late-season trades. I won't even think about the ticket prices that bar many fans from ever seeing a Major League game in person. I'll be caught up in the ageless pageantry of baseball, and when that first pitch crosses the plate, all my memories will be of Exeter, Nebraska, a little town that gave a man's life back to him. So here's a redemption story. A beautiful little story about how that one fact, that one season, turned a man's life around and gave him hope. Tomorrow night, we're going to be showing Field of Dreams right here. At 8:45, I think. And if you come, you know, you'll find another kind of redemption that happens in that movie, reconciliations, fulfillment of dreams, all of these phrases that are a part of baseball life. And Bring a handkerchief. Because you'll both be needing it for the laughter and the crying. Okay, now what in the world do we do in a college course other than talk about some interesting historical things? First time I taught this baseball course, I was a visiting professor at McAllister College in St. Paul. And most of the students were from St. Thomas University, a mile down the road from McAllister. So here is the same old teacher at McAllister College teaching St. Thomas students. It was a little weird. And I got my first warning when I walked in, and the fairly large auditorium was filled with first-year students wearing their high school letter jackets. they were not far enough along in their college careers to realize you don't wear your high school letter jacket at college. And they had never taken a one-month January course, which this one was. And after the first, after they got the syllabus handed out and the reading list and the first couple of assignments and the news of the papers they were going to have to write, a contingency of three came to me after the class was over. They'd been selected by their classmates to do this and said, sir, we didn't know we were going to have to read about baseball or write about it or think about it in these ways. We thought we were just going to sit around and talk baseball. So they were a little surprised by what we do. But here are some of the topics we take up, and I'll just give you a brief explanation, and again, interrupt me at any point if you'd like, of why baseball is, in my judgment, and the judgment of many others, I think, the sport that in the most satisfying way can fulfill a study of culture and a study of not only who we are collectively, but who we are individually. I've always wanted to try to tap the sources of this baseball interest of mine, and many others like to do that as well. Well, I'm an English professor, and we take up literature. There is a baseball book published in this country every day of the year, every year. 400 books a year, come out about baseball. Now, they aren't all great literature. Many of them are written by utility infielders who make $3 million a year and, have some story to tell.
And some spare time.
Pardon?
And some spare time.
And some spare time, that's right.
And a ghostwriter.
But there are great novels. Some of our best novelists have taken up writing about baseball. So, I'll tell you the kinds of questions that we ask, and there's no simple answer to any one of these questions, but these are the things that we take up in the class. Why do so many American novelists use baseball as a framework for their stories? What kinds of themes and topics do they address? And why is there a baseball book published every day of the year? We take up language. If we had another half hour and started to list all the baseball metaphors that have entered our language, we could fill several of these chalkboards with them. Do any of you have favorite baseball terms? We touch base with each other.
Struck out.
Struck out again. Born with two strikes against me. Can't get to first base with her. And some of the more esoteric ones, like a can of corn. You know what a can of corn is in baseball? Did I hear it?
A high pop fly.
An easy to catch, a soft pop fly. And why is it called a can of corn?
So corn is on the top shelf of the grocery market, and
Right.
Pick it off the shelf and catch it.
In the old grocery stores, the grocer had one of these long-handled sticks and an apron, and he'd pull a can of corn off and right into his apron and always catch it. So that became the baseball term. We could come up with all sorts of them. One of my favorites came out of the Democratic National Convention in, what year was it? About 1988, I think. And Ann Richardson, the governor of Texas, was giving the keynote address for the Republicans, and was it George Bush? The Democratic National Convention, and it was when George Bush, George Bush the Elder, was running against, who did we end up with?
Dukakis,
thank you. And he was talking about the privileged nature of the family from which George Bush came from, and her metaphor was this: George Bush was born on third base, she said, but he thinks he hit a triple.
See, I have a question.
Yes.
I've read it in some English novels where people are talking, or where Americans are talking, and someone will say, I was just spitballing. What does that mean? If an English novelist uses that, an American is saying, I was spitballing.
Probably that I was deceiving you, because a spitball is
illegal.
I've not heard that,
that
term, but
wondering.
You aren't supposed to put a foreign substance on the baseball, and that's probably what it was, some kind of deception.
Thank you.
Okay, I better run through these quickly, because we are now at 8:25, and although baseball is one of the rare sports that plays without a clock, and the game can go on indefinitely if it's tied, I don't think we should go on indefinitely tonight, but I want to put a few more questions into your minds to think about. And one is, why have so many baseball terms come into our language? And why were nicknames so important? You know, the little exercise we went through before. And you know, why has that lost some importance? Then religion is one of the most fascinating things. Another thing we could fill a blackboard with are all of those characteristics of baseball that coincide with characteristics of religion. You know, there's an annual rhythms of when things start and finish. There are ceremonies, there are officiants, there are liturgies, countless ways in which we can compare religion and baseball in ways that are fairly scary. Why are so many Americans devoted to baseball? Why do we make pilgrimages to sacred places? And we usually use the term pilgrimage when we're going to Fenway Park or Wrigley Field or Cooperstown for the first time. And it's just a very common thing for people, common language to use. Why do we collect sacred relics? You know, why is it precious to have a baseball with Barry Bonds' autograph? You know, why do people just almost kill each other in the stands to catch a certain kind of home run that perhaps set a new record and it sells for $1 million and so forth? The baseball cards. I collect baseball cards, and I have to keep asking myself why. But I do love to do it. And some of these little pieces of cardboard sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars. I even discovered that my hero, Andy Pafko, who is not a Hall of Famer, and probably most of you have never heard of him, but he was my hero, played outfield for the Cubs and the Dodgers and the Milwaukee Braves. He was a very good player, but not all that great. We were driving out to Holden a few summers ago, and I saw the name in the headlines of the newspaper we had just bought, and I read that his baseball card, his 1952 baseball card, had just sold at auction for $86,000. And Karen said, David, we could, and I have this card. I have it. She said, David, we could sell the card and build a cabin. You know, and I said, I'm not going to sell that. Then economics. Why and how do we devote so much public and personal money to professional sports? Why do we do this? And how have baseball and other sports moved marginalized people into the economic mainstream? You know, there's a negative issue and a positive. A lot of people who have been historically marginalized groups have become multimillionaires through not just baseball, but other sports as well. But how do we justify the expenditures for stadia with movable roofs and, you know, all of these things that when teachers are going underpaid and social workers are being laid off, and yet we do this. And then we who love baseball go to the games anyway and pay $15 or $30 for a ticket. And some people don't have to pay for the tickets, John, but you do now. And yeah. Then psychology. One of the fascinating things for me is, why is it that some of us are forever loyal to the same team, and others of us become fans of the nearby, the local team? There are people who live in Brooklyn who are Los Angeles Dodgers fans and will be till the day they die, because their team were the Dodgers, and there they are in L.A. now, and Walter O'Malley will never be forgiven by these people for moving the team out there.
Warren Salveson was a good example of that.
Okay.
Born in Brooklyn, and what did he read to his mother on her deathbed? The Boys of Summer.
Mm-hmm. Okay, there it is. A book about the teams of the 50s. Yeah, the Brooklyn Dodgers of the 50s. Yeah. And why do cities go crazy when our teams win the pennant or the World Series? You know, they have a bad season one year and nobody goes, you know, but next year if the Mariners have another season when they win 116 games as they did a few years ago, you know, the stadium will be filled and win the pennant or the World Series, why, there'll be vast celebrations.
We were living in Detroit in the year after the Detroit riots, and the Tigers beat St. Louis in the World Series, and it was just pandemonium and called the healing of the city.
Yeah, there you are. There's another redemptive thing that a sport like baseball can do.
And the question remains, why?
Is still why should that be? Karen and I have tickets to the Twins World Series in 1987. And Twins won the World Series, winning the last game at home. And we went out and danced in the streets till after midnight, you know, with everyone else. I mean, there was no way we could have gotten our car out of the parking lot.
Dance away.
Yeah, and it was a marvelous thing to be there. Ethics. Do sports teach character? And if so, what characteristics do we learn? And, you know, we're embarrassed almost weekly by some new scandal, some new hero, Rafael Palmeiro, perhaps the classic example this season. Sammy Sosa and his corked bat a few seasons ago. There's always some scandal that where players are trying to win in any way they can, even by breaking the rules. It's hard to hold up professional sports, at least, as an example of living the ethical life. in history, it's fascinating to see how baseball has developed along with certain eras of American history. It has its own creation myth that's untrue, and it's fascinating. Is baseball really the American pastime, and why or why not? Many people would like to claim that baseball is passé, and now it's professional basketball or professional football, or that sandlot baseball has been replaced by soccer. Is baseball still what we might call America's pastime? Then, metaphysics. So I'd love to take up metaphysics, and this is sort of a discussion of the nature of things, how baseball works. It's a fascinating thing to study sports and figure out how, you know, what are the factors that go into a sport, you know, the boundaries, the clock. In baseball, the team that's on offense cannot touch the ball. Fairly unusual sport in that respect. There's very little warlike behavior in baseball. Most ball and puck kind of sports have a boundary, and one team is defending its home country, the end zone, and the other team's job is to break through the line of the defenders and punch through and score. And you think of the metaphors that are used for football, bomb, blitz, you know, all of these very violent ones. Whereas in baseball, you take a walk, you go around the circle, and you come home. And this is oversimplifying a bit, but you know, it's a much more gentle kind of
thing. That's modern baseball. That's not Pat Cobb baseball.
That's right.
Lou Piniella.
Yeah, baseball was much rougher in the earlier days. The town ball game was a different thing. And yeah, there were a lot of ruffians in baseball. And we've smoothed it out a little bit. That's right. Aesthetics. Is baseball beautiful? Do some of us go because it's beautiful? We walk into a stadium, into Yankee Stadium or Fenway Park, and you just takes your breath away, whether you're this tall or this tall. The geometries of baseball, the symmetries, are they any better than other sports? Is beauty a part of our fascination with baseball? Statistics. This is the big one, right? In baseball, virtually every act is counted. The number of pitches a pitcher throws in a game, you know, the number of hits, errors, walks, earned run average, all these statistical things are counted up. And some of us remember them. And we care about them. And when somebody is going to break the record, you know, the whole nation just follows it in a kind of fanatic way. Karen has always given me a bad time that the largest book in my library is the Baseball Encyclopedia. And if you see the movie Field of Dreams tomorrow night, you'll see James Earl Jones sitting there out at the Field of Dreams reading through the Baseball Encyclopedia, and it's a very big fat book. Ann, is your hand up to make a point, or are you just resting? Okay. You know, you get used to watching the third base coach. I wasn't sure. Sociology, what role does baseball and other sports play in our social arrangements, like the development of cities, the survival of small towns, race relations, the status of women? And there are many good things and many lamentable things that sports have done, the roles that sports have played and are still playing in some of these things. I'll tell you one story that is my favorite baseball sociology story. When Jackie Robinson became the first modern the first black player to play in modern baseball. And do we all remember the season? Some of us anyway?
46.
1 year off, it was 1947 that he finally got to play. In 46 he played for Montreal, but they were still a minor league team. In 1947, when the major leagues were much smaller than they are now, and the Brooklyn Dodgers, for whom Robinson played, made their first sort of southern road trip, they went to St. Louis. And at that time, St. Louis was the only major league city in a southern state. And there were lots of black people in St. Louis, but lots of racism alive and well. And the St. Louis Cardinal team reported that when the Brooklyn Dodgers came to play them at their home stadium, they would not take the field against the team that had a black man playing for them.
Oh.
And Ford Frick, bless his heart, who at that time was the president of the National League and later the commissioner of baseball, quickly sent off a message to the St. Louis Cardinal team and said, if you men do not take the field tomorrow against the Brooklyn Dodgers, none of you will ever play another Major League Baseball game in your life. And at that time, the commissioner and the league presidents acting for the commissioner had that power. Cardinals played the game, a huge race riot was avoided, and you know, racial progress happened through sport and baseball more quickly than it did in Congress. And then finally, art, film, music, theater. There are so many good baseball movies these days. A baseball play won the Tony Award a couple seasons ago, Take Me Out. As the best play of the year in this country. And movies like Field of Dreams, you know, are...
Damn Yankees.
Damn Yankees, yeah, one of the great musicals, Bull Durham. A lot of great movies. A lot of bad ones, too, but they are good movies. So baseball has permeated all these aspects of our culture and perhaps some others, and some of them take us days to address in a college course. And I apologize for having to try to cram it all into 20 or 25 minutes here at the end of this hour. But I hope that for those of you who love baseball, that you continue to do so, and those of you who don't love baseball, you'll mature eventually. Just kidding. But for many of us, as you know, it's a great pleasure, and we like to share it with each other and our loved ones, and we're always delighted when somebody we know and love discovers baseball and takes pleasure in it. Well, okay, a couple questions. Jan?
Well, as you know, we walk every morning with Sparky Anderson, and I ask him sometimes what he thinks about Little League baseball and where the best players are coming from and so on. And as many of you know, a lot of the best players come from the Dominican Republic. And I asked him why. And he said, sandlot baseball. We organize these kids too much. We've got them. Well, you know, I think he maybe carries it a little too far, but his notion is just let them play.
Yeah.
You know.
Make the parents stay home.
Don't, yeah. And thinking of not exactly a sandlot, but what was the first thing the Holton Village miners did with the only flat piece of ground they found up here in the valley?
Made a baseball park.
They made a baseball park down there. And
go ahead.
Yeah.
In your history, do you talk about the women that played baseball during the war?
Yes. Yeah.
And the history of the black baseball teams.
Yeah,
that
the Negro Leagues, we called them then, and the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League.
Yeah.
That was the title of the teams that were started up in the Chicago Lake Michigan area to take up the interest in baseball and spread it out a little bit while the men were off at in war. And it lasted till I think 1954. And this was the movie A League of Their Own.
Mm-hmm.
Was based on that.
I always
thank
think
you
that
for
a
that.
Partial answer for why it might be a national pastime is that as little ones we could all play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Girls and
yeah.
boys together.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't true for football. It may mean that soccer really comes into its own in this country because
yeah.
there's a lot of soccer playing girls. But
yeah, and I think soccer is a wonderful new sport for our nation, at least, because it requires very little equipment, and young people of all physiques, you know, can play. Unlike, it's hard to be a basketball player when you're 4'10". Hard to be a football player when you're not pretty husky. John?
Are you going to write the book now?
The book, you know, number 401.
Baseball at Holden.
Baseball at Holden, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe someday, yeah.
Yeah. Will you still teach it?
I'm not teaching anymore at college, but I get to teach at a place like this, so I'll keep doing it if I'm asked. Yeah.
Oh, first the question. Am I right that the number of black Major League Baseball players percentage has gone down recently, and what's the reason?
I don't know what the reason.
There's been a book about it recently, and it's Sandlot Baseball. They're playing basketball in the streets, and they don't have gear, they don't have the money for gear, but all it takes is a basketball to play basketball. You really don't even
yeah.
need the hoop.
Yeah.
And they're all playing basketball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And right. baseball goes where the players are. Mm-hmm. So that's why they're coming out of Venezuela and Dominican Republic
yeah.
and all that.
Yeah, the Seattle paper recently ran an article showing how the percentage has diminished over the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, he said he did one team. It was watched a game and there wasn't a black player on the field.
Mm-hmm.
A major league
yeah.
game. Mm-hmm. Not one.
The other question I have is the connection of baseball and patriotism. I know since 9/11 it was became very common to sing God Bless America.
Yeah.
And is that going to, will that continue or was that?
I don't think it will continue. Because baseball has its national anthem, which is Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But I suspect that will just quietly disappear. Maybe not in New York. Do they still do that in Seattle or
what?
Sing God Bless America right after the seventh inning stretch.
Did they?
No, I don't think so. I think
yeah, I think that will fade. Last of all in New York.
Well, don't they open the Twins games with
the National?
The
National.
Yeah. Well, we've been sitting for a long time. I'd be glad to, you know, answer other questions, but I want to make it easy for you to get up and stretch and leave if you wish.
Is this the seventh inning? Can we start a wave?
Yeah.
Thank you, Dave.